So we're stripping this ancient prayer down to its component parts because we want to understand it. And we want to understand why this practice has remained part of our tradition through the centuries. We want to draw benefit from this ancient practice without getting sidetracked by some of the barnacles that have encrusted it through those centuries. And it is the prayer of confession, or as we have reframed it, the prayer of self-awareness and the prayer of self-disclosure. So we've seen the basic outline of this prayer in three steps. Step one is to pay attention to our negative emotions. Step two is to undertake a thorough self-examination. And then step three is to engage forthright self-disclosure. We're a couple weeks into the steps now. The first week we looked at step one. We saw how our minds and our culture conspire together to keep us from paying attention to our negative emotions. And then last week we moved to step two, and we began to look more extensively at it, and we will for a couple of weeks. And we started with an understanding that throughout the centuries, this ancient practice of confession has always begun with a prayer. A prayer for help. And so why, we looked at, why would the ancients train us to begin this way? And it is because, we saw, that our minds are wired for habit. We are wired to do what we have always done. And so consequently, with that wiring, we tend not to see the instincts and the impulses and the reflexes that keep us doing what we've always done. I told a story last week about Isuzu awareness. We saw how the initial prayer for help before we undertake a thorough self-examination works as a prayer of watchfulness, a prayer of helping us activate our seeing, activating our seeing of the things that we tend not to see, to help us have, as Jesus prayed for us, eyes that see and ears that hear. So if you missed any of the lessons leading up to today, I encourage you to have a listen online now that the website is back up. And by the way, I am doing a podcast on rethinking sexual education. However, if you saw pornography on our church website last week, I want you to know that is not part of the sex education that I am rethinking. Karen told me that we were hacked while I was in California and infected with malware. So if you saw pornography on our website, I want to clarify that is not what we're doing when we're rethinking our sex education. So anyway, we return to step two, undertaking a thorough self-examination. Now, as we have seen, the trigger that tells us that it is time for pulling this tool from our spiritual toolbox is often an emotion and often a negative emotion. But because we create in ourselves all of these clever strategies to help us avoid paying attention to our emotions, sometimes we don't see them when they come. So we'll be grinding away with worry during the night hours, or we'll be hot under the collar toward a coworker, or maybe we'll be anxious about the kids, or perhaps feeling rejected by the other parents at the school, and we'll be hours and maybe days and maybe weeks into the afflictive emotion and never notice that we're having it, never paying attention to the power that that emotion is having over us and over our lives, and never being triggered to pull out this prayer and to use it. So we have a complementary practice in this second step of self-examination to help us, and it is called the prayer of examine. Now, this also is an ancient form of prayer, and if you've been at NRCC for any length of time, you've been invited into the practice of the prayer of examine. It was originally instituted by Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Society of Jesus several centuries ago. And it's a way to build self-examination into our daily lives, to help us see those negative emotions that we tend not to see when they come. On the weeks that I lead contemplative Sundays during our worship time, we will often do some iteration of this prayer of examine. In particular, there's one part of the prayer of examine that I have found very helpful. It is to read through the list of the ancient virtues. Virtues are virtues because over the centuries we have found them to be character attributes that work. So consequently, honesty works, and it has stood the test of time, so now it has become enshrined as a virtue. Dishonesty also works. It'll help get you out of a pinch. It'll help you get you out of a pickle. It'll work, but it doesn't have staying power. Consequently, the negative effects over a period of time show that dishonesty doesn't work. Meanness will work. It will get you what you want in short order. But we found over the long haul, over a lifetime, compassion works. So compassion has been enshrined as a virtue. And so consequently, the things that work often signal a deep and abiding truth. And a deep and abiding truth gives us a sense of the movement of the divine. And so consequently, those deepest things, the things that are the deepest truths, the things that work, often are a reflection of God. And so the list of virtues are often expressed on one of our lists called the fruit of the Spirit of God. And so what we do in these moments of examination is simply read through the list, inserting a pause after each word. So we read love, and we wait a moment, and joy, and peace, and patience, and kindness. And in that pause in between, we're listening for an interior nudge or an interior check, or we're listening for something that we would characterize as a prompting from the indwelling Spirit of God. And should we, as we're reading through the list, have one of those pause moments, one of those pay attention moments, one of those something bubbling up moments, we stop there and we begin to pull on the thread of that small nudge. And we unravel that by paying attention to what comes up in our hearts. So perhaps I have a nudge or a prompt around the word love. And as I pause, maybe a moment comes to mind, a moment in which I felt unloved, or a moment in which I was unloving. And then we begin to see what we might not have seen had we not been paying attention. We begin to see, there's an afflictive emotion. There's a moment that I was not heeding. So we sense these interior nudges by simply reading through these lists of the ancient wisdom that works, the virtue curriculum. So perhaps we're pausing at the word patience, and one of those interior promptings comes up, and maybe we see a moment in our mind's eye in which we were impatient or in which we were the brunt of someone else's impatience, and we see, there's an afflictive emotion. Now, if this was a lesson on the prayer of examine, we would pause now and we would speak about how important it is to also unravel our positive emotions, the time in which we sense the positive side of patience or love or kindness, and that is very important. Ignatius called it times of consolation and desolation, but you can hear about that another time. Right now, we're focusing on confession and looking for these afflictive emotions. One of the tools of the prayer of self-awareness, the prayer of self-disclosure, is to have that list handy to help us trigger our own watchfulness, to help trigger our seeing what we might not have seen, what we typically would not have been looking for or paying attention to. And that simple practice of reading and pausing, reading and pausing, will often expose us to the interior nudges of the indwelling Spirit of God. Now, interestingly, we have a bookmark. And on that bookmark, there's an outline of the prayer of examine, four simple questions we ask ourselves. But there's also a list of the fruit of the Spirit and a list of the virtues, the four cardinal virtues, what our tradition calls the seven heavenly virtues. They're the counterpoint to the seven deadly sins. And those bookmarks are free if you get a paper one. They're 50 cents if you get the laminated one. There's also some really good books over there. Well, there's one really good book over there. And so, to aid us in our prayer of self-awareness, our prayer of self-disclosure, it is a valuable practice to slowly, as we breathe, simply read through those virtue words and listen. Listen for the interior promptings of the Spirit of God. This will aid us in our quest for self-awareness. This will aid us in the prayer Jesus made for us, that we would have eyes that see and we would have ears that hear. These virtue lists act as a kind of moral inventory checklist. They help us listen within and ask important questions like, how am I doing with peace or with peacelessness? How am I doing with contentedness or with envy? How am I doing with kindness or with selfishness? So by keeping the virtue curriculum ever before us, we see what we would often miss in the busyness of daily life. By taking these moments on a regular basis to reflect on the ancient virtues, we use them to hold up a plumb line to our daily lives. And we see ourselves in ways that we would easily miss, because life is busy. And oftentimes our experiences just get warehoused away, unseen and unprocessed. And this practice of self-awareness is a prayer of seeing what is there and not avoiding it. Taking a regular survey of our own interior worlds, our emotional worlds. So the next part of this second step that I have found particularly helpful is to write down what we see. We go through the trouble of using the bookmark. We have the experience of one of those interior nudges of the Holy Spirit. But brains being what brains are and brains doing what brains do, there's a good chance that even so, even having done that, we will get distracted. We'll not let the awareness that we have touched seep in very deeply, because our brains are masters at that. They're masters at getting on with the noisy thing, getting on with the urgent thing, and not going very deeply with the important thing, but the often quiet thing. So writing things down becomes a powerful tool to awaken ourselves to Isuzu watchfulness. Now, for me, I use bullet points, and I just jot things down that way, but other people use journaling. That works for many. Some write letters to people that they have no intention of ever sending. Afflictive emotions are our friends, but not if we don't feel them. And insights are transformative, but not if we don't heed them. And when we write something down, it forces our minds into focus mode. We discipline our minds. We channel our thoughts. We accentuate those thoughts and insights that we have, and we amplify them in our awareness. Random thoughts flitting through our heads don't go as deeply as the ones that we write down. So we undertake a thorough self-examination. We see ourselves, we use the tool of examine, we feel our afflictive emotions, we notice ourselves behaving in a reactionary way, and we write down the things that we see. And then we get to the heart of the practice of self-examination. We ask ourselves questions. We ask ourselves questions like, why am I doing the thing that I see myself doing? What does it mean when I do that? We ask ourselves the most basic questions. What am I afraid of? What am I angry about? What hurt me? Why am I sad? As we've seen earlier in this lesson, we listen to our bodies. We explore the physical sensations that are associated with emotion. Our bodies tell us when we feel ashamed. There is actually a physical sensation associated with shame. There is a sensation associated with feeling betrayed. There is a feeling that my body uses to tell me that I'm feeling discouraged or that I'm feeling overwhelmed. And so we take the time to translate what our bodies are telling us into these sensations, translate them into thoughts, and then begin to articulate them in words to bring them up with this reality in our bodies and name them in our minds. That exercise of naming what our body is telling us helps us in our quest for self-examination. We saw the first week of this section that the things that we find to which we are typically blind, the things that we find when we pay attention to our bodies and to our thoughts, when we begin to ask the questions, the things that we find have a recurring nature about them. There is usually some primal drive behind our afflictive emotions. For some, it is the drive to be safe in a dangerous world. That's often the case for Enneagrams 5s and 6s and 7s. And if that drive is there, there's a very good chance that that same drive will be driving us tomorrow in some other iteration. It's a recurring process. For some, the drive is to keep the world under control and to have to carry the world, to carry the weight of arranging the world as it should be on our own shoulders. That's often the case for Enneagrams 8s and 9s and 1s. And so, that same drive will still be driving us tomorrow in some other iteration. Maybe our primal fear is that we will be rejected or abandoned or found wanting by the people who matter to us most, which is often true for Enneagrams 2s and 3s and 4s. And if so, that same primal fear will be driving us tomorrow. So, over time, by practicing these simple tools of reading through the lists, of pausing and paying attention, of asking ourselves the question, we begin to get familiar with the interior territory. We begin to see things that we have seen before. We make part of our awareness this interior territory where there are pitfalls and hazards and traps that the false self sets for us, and we often find ourselves seeing them coming before we hit them because we've seen them before. And it is the questions that we ask ourselves that help us come to this level of familiarity of what's going on within. Our conscious awareness of the interior landscape of our souls and the pitfalls that tend to trap us, these begin to become familiar territory. So, as we're framing the kinds of questions that we ask ourselves, it's helpful to think about the layers of our humanity. So, I love circles. Here's a good way of thinking about our human experience, our human condition. Imagine that that inner circle, the yellow one, that the breath of God, the divine life in us, the indwelling Holy Spirit. But around that, we carry another layer that kind of encases it. We carry what we've called existential shame, the sense that there's something wrong with us. We all carry that. I am less than the divine light that is deep within me. Or as Paul would say it, what's wrong with me? The things that I hate, I do, and the things that I want to do, I don't do. The human condition, in religious language, we speak of that layer as the sin that so easily besets us. That's in one of our texts. The stuckness of our lives, the blindness of our souls. That, our tradition tells us, is part of the human condition. In other language, we could speak of the upper brain and the lower brain, as we've done in the past. These are things we've discussed before. But the outer layers of the circle speak to the parts of awareness that we can touch, but often, because we're distracted, do not. When a negative emotional response comes up, often we are so immersed in the experience of that feeling that we never ask ourselves the first layer question. What story am I telling myself that has produced this negative emotion that I am now feeling? I am really upset because my spouse has once again left dishes on the coffee table. Now, I usually don't ask myself, what story am I telling myself about the dishes on the coffee table? Or if I do, it only goes as far as, that's just wrong. It's not fair that I should have to pick up those dishes. It's disrespectful. He or she is just a slob, and there is a moral superiority to tidiness over slobbiness, and this I am right. But the tip-off that there's more to the story than just that is the many, many, many times that someone does some other knuckleheaded thing and we don't have the same volatile emotional response. On the website, there are a couple of YouTube videos under the heading of conflict somewhere in which I talk about the 25-3 rule. 25 knuckleheaded things happen by the people around us, but only three really get under our skin. 22 of them evoke an eye roll. Oh, what an idiot. But three of them, Vesuvius. Which tells us that the story we are telling ourselves about this, the one that most of the time we don't see, is not the trivialized reductionist version of the story we think it is. The reaction itself is telling us that the story that is dictating our thoughts and dictating our feelings and dictating our actions is happening below a layer of awareness, and it's a bigger story than we know. So, in the prayer of confession, we are asking ourselves what the story is. What story am I telling myself about this situation? When she leaves that dish there again for the umpteenth time, here's what I think's going on. She is just like my mother. She's doing the same out-of-control thing that my family did when I was growing up. It's the same kind of craziness that is going to dog me even here into this relationship, because if you get out of control with the dishes and you can't manage your own life around dishes, it won't be long before you can't manage your own life around emotions, and damn it, I've seen that. And I'm not going back to that. If you can't keep control of your own life around emotions, you can't keep it around money, and you can't keep it around sex, and you can't keep it around food, and we are on a slippery slope to destruction, and as God is my witness, we will not go back there again. Now, I've been kind, and I've been gentle, and I've tried to stave off this destruction, but she is going there anyway, and I will not let that happen. Or, when he doesn't carry in his dishes, he's just showing how little he respects my time and my energy and my fatigue. And if he will dishonor me there, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump before he, like my father, puts me in that same category of, oh, she's just a girl. Many have tried to limit my power. Some have succeeded. But as God is my witness, never again. My voice is not going to be shut down. My potential will not be limited. My dreams will not be set aside in service to another. And now we see it's not just a dish. It's dishonor. It's not just a dish. It's a squandered destiny. And it's not just a dish. It's a power differential. So I might get really pissy. I might start acting very obstreperously. My actions and my words may become hostile and bad-tempered, and I might try to punish the other person for the bad thing that he or she has done or said, and I might myself take on a bad action or say some horrible things. I'll especially have some bad thoughts, but often all of that will happen, and I will not understand why. I'll just know that's not fair, that's not right, that's not good, because I never ask myself the question, what story am I telling myself? And I settle for the most trivial version of the story. The person is bad. The circumstance is bad. The situation is bad. But we don't understand the interior narrative that is driving us. Vesuvius erupts, and we just point at the lava. We don't understand the magma structure that's going on under the surface. Anxiety erupts. Recrimination erupts. Blame erupts, and we have no idea of the story that is at work under the surface. Next week, we'll get more into how feelings work in this layer of self-awareness. You can see in the second circle down. And we'll see that as we become more of the aware of the feelings that we feel, it serves a backfilling function to help more deeply inform us about the stories we tell ourselves. Today I just wanted to give you an example of that. We'll talk about it next week. I work out my story of the dishes and why I'm having a reaction. And I realize it's about my slippery slope, the fear. If we let one area of our lives get out of control, it'll be a quick downhill slide. But then I start scanning my body for feelings. And while I'm doing that, I realize there's something there. While I do that, I realize, if I pay attention, I have the sensation in my body, the emotion of distrust or mistrust. And suddenly, I have access to another layer, another depth of my own interior story, the story I tell myself. And I begin to see that I tell myself a story that people can't be trusted. I'm in this dangerous world, but I'm in it alone. People just let you down. You can't count on anybody. And I can't trust her. I can't trust him. And I come to realize this dish is about more than the slippery slope. It's about the backlog of significant people who have let me down, a backlog of those I thought I could trust, but that it turned out I couldn't. And now you are in my life, significant person, and you are my best hope in this deep relationship where I want to know and be known, love and be loved. It is here that I have my best chance to trust and be trusted. And the dish tells me, nope, not even here. I can't trust anyone. They will do what is best for them, but not for me, and they'll do it every time. Now that's a pretty painful belief system to come to see. That's a pretty painful belief system to realize is going on inside. So no wonder we do whatever we can not to look at it. I'm having this powerful negative emotional response because there is some story inside that I am fighting like crazy not to see. I don't want to see that story. If I slow down long enough to actually see that it's there and to come to realize that I live in a world in which the people around me cannot be trusted, in which I am in this world alone, then that will give that story more power over me, and I am backpedaling like crazy to keep that out of my conscious awareness. I don't want to see that excruciatingly painful story. Self-awareness is no picnic. Digging into my afflictive emotions is dangerous. The very fact that they're still afflictive, that they are the three, the very fact that it's creating this response is telling me that when I get down there and find it, I'm not going to like what I find. It is going to be unpleasant. It is going to be demanding. It is going to be daunting. And so it's with good reason that my mind plays all these tricks to keep me from ever seeing what's going on inside of me. But how can I make a prayer of confession, the prayer of self-awareness and self-disclosure? How can I engage in the ancient practice of the prayers of detachment, detaching from the story that I tell myself, if I don't know what that story is? And so, as we've said, the prayer of confession requires that we screw our courage to the sticking point. We undertake a thorough self-examination, what the 12-step tradition calls a fearless moral inventory, with the emphasis being on the courage required to be fearless. Step 2 of the prayer of confession begins with a prayer for help, a prayer that will heighten our desire and our attentiveness on the spiritual journey. Step 2 of the prayer of confession uses the prayer of examine, a tool a list of the ancient virtues that we read and pause and listen within, giving space for those interior nudges of awareness. Step two of the prayer of confession invites us to write down the things that we see and to bring them into a more focused place in our minds. Step two of the prayer of confession invites us to ask a series of self-awareness questions, beginning with, what is the story that I'm telling myself? Okay, we'll pick up here next week. Spirit of God, may we be self-aware. May we be people attentive to what's going on inside. May we be people of deep transformation. In Jesus' name, amen.